This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, if I say to you, name an actor who held political office, you'll immediately say Ronald Reagan and then probably Arnold Schwarzenegger. If you were English, though, a different name would come to mind, and that's Glenda Jackson.
Well, in the past 2 days, you have picked me up in the rain, given me tea, bought me lunch, and lured me to this hideaway with the intention, I presume, of getting me into bed for what you Americans so charmingly call a quickie. Is that a fair resume so far?
Why do women always think the worst? Why does sex always have to be the first thing that... Yes.
Jackson became a powerhouse actress in the early 70s, winning all kinds of awards for her stage roles, and she won Oscars for Women in Love and A Touch of Class. Then in 1992, reacting to the impact of Thatcherism on the United Kingdom, Jackson stood for Parliament. She became an MP for the Labour Party, and after representing her district for more than 20 years, she finally stepped down, and now she's back on Broadway. I just saw Jackson in a production of Edward Albee's Three Tall Women, and she plays the character called A, an imperious 90-something who's, of course, diminished by age, but still full of fight and wit. Jackson, who's only 82, remains at the very height of her powers, and she's been nominated for a Tony Award. I have to tell you, this play and performances, they're extraordinary. And at the same time, you have to know that when your audience is sitting there, they don't know how you do it night after night. Emotionally, this play is wrenching. And for this to be your job, to inhabit this role and do it, I don't know how many times a week.
Well, we do it 8 times a week, but there are only 3 of us in the play. It is remarkably, well, demanding in the right kind of way as a play, because these characters have layers, and the layers are revealed during the process of the evening. But within the play, as within all good plays, there is an energy. That is what gives you, in addition to your own energies, the capacity to find those characters, find them anew every performance.
The play is about essential things. It's about aging. It's about the evolution of a person. It's about death. Are you worn out, wrenched out when the evening is over?
No, partly because in a strange kind of way, you should have nothing to take home. I mean, you should have put everything that has to be put on that stage.
And left it in the theater.
And if it hasn't been there, you know, shame on you if you have something to take home. So, no.
You have a history with Edward Albee. You were in Virginia Woolf many years
ago,
right?
He directed Virginia Woolf when we did it in Los Angeles. I think it must have been 1990 or something like that.
Now, am I wrong to think that you didn't get along 100%?
It wasn't that we didn't get along. I mean, he was like a man in a glass case. I mean, there seemed to be no capacity within him for ordinary human exchange. I can't remember him ever smiling. I can't remember him ever going, you know, for a drink with us or anything like that. And I think I got off on the wrong foot the very first day of rehearsal, because George and Margaret come in and they're drunk and they're coming into their house. And he said to me, now it's dark and, you know, she should sort of stumble before she finds a place to put. I said, doesn't she know where the light switch is? Doesn't she live here? And that was not the answer. That was not
badly.
The response that he wanted.
How did he react?
He just froze even more. I mean, I've been very lucky in my career. I've worked with some great directors and they all share the same thing. They know what they don't want. They expect you to show them what they do. And they are as vulnerable as you are in one sense, because not infrequently they will say, is there a production to be found here? Is there something in this? And I don't think that ever occurred to Albee. I think in a strange way, well, not a strange way, a perfectly understandable way, Virginia Woolf was both his greatest prize and his greatest curse, because all his work post-Virginia Woolf was compared to it.
Now, you've returned from politics to do theater, and what is your goal in selecting projects to do? You've done King Lear as Lear, and now you're doing Three Tall Women on Broadway. How do you select?
Well, I mean, I didn't leave politics to return to theater. I mean, I'd been in my constituency for 23 years. I thought it was about time somebody else had a go. And the Old Vic, which is a theater that I've worked in before, approached me. Now, the play they wanted me to do, I didn't particularly want to do.
What was that?
I can't remember it now. But anyway, one of my closest friends, Nuria Esper, who is a brilliant Spanish actress, was doing Lear in Barcelona, so I went to see her. And it was a great production. I mean, she was fantastic. And I said to her, you know, this is marvelous. She said, well, why don't you do it? So I said, come on. I said, me? I said, Lear being played by a woman in England, it would never be allowed. So anyway, I suggested to the Vic that I do Lear. And they said, yeah, okay, fine. So we did it.
Yeah, okay, fine. That was it.
Well, there were, I think, difficulties in the first instance, partly because they're not a million miles away from the Globe Theatre. And so they thought there might be that Shakespearean, you know, overkill. But then they said, yes, fine, we did it. And what really interested me, and this was a direct experience from having been an MP, actually, that as part of being an MP, obviously, I would visit old people's homes, day centres, things of that nature. One of the really interesting things for me was that as we age, those gender barriers begin to crack. They begin to fray. They get misty, whether we are aware of it as a development.
Because,
I think we are
because
now.
Because sex itself begins to recede a little bit?
Oh, I don't think it's that. No, no. I mean, I've seen no reduction, truly, in that kind of libido in age itself. No, I think that's, you know, one of the things that possibly stays with us. But it was just that acceptance that there can be similarities on a human level, mostly probably the emotional level, that are not risible or dismissible simply because of age.
The play, just to return to the Albee play that you're in now, is it's three women on stage, and in many ways it's the same woman at three different stages of life. We're meant to think that, certainly. And I wonder about how you think about the 26-year-old Glenda Jackson. And do you ever see yourself on television or films and get interested, or you turn the channel?
No, I mean, I watch a film that I'm in, and my thoughts are, why in the name of all that's holy did you choose to do that? And there's absolutely nothing you can do to change it anymore. So it's a kind of, you whip yourself. Well, I think most actors are sadomasochists, actually. Why do we put ourselves through this torment? Because it is torment.
It is.
Absolutely it is. I worked with the most wonderful actress called Mona Washbourne. She was a wonderful, wonderful actress, had an absolutely sterling reputation, was respected by everybody. And we did a play together. And every night, before the curtain went up, she's sitting on the sofa and I'm sitting here in an armchair, and she's saying, dear God, let me die. Dear God, let me die. And it wasn't some kind of mantra or something like that. She meant it. You are always, always afraid. And it's only when the curtain goes up or the lights go on or whatever, you cannot afford that self-indulgence.
Musicians describe this. They say the easy part of the day is the 2 hours on stage, because you're
absolutely
out of yourself, you're giving of yourself.
Absolutely. You're working with other people. You're not alone with a character. I mean, yes. I mean, let me give you this is an apocryphal story, but I believe that it is absolutely true. Olivier was doing Othello. And it was part of the repertoire. It wasn't the first night. It wasn't just the first. But this particular night, he was being particularly brilliant to such an extent that the other members of the cast didn't want to leave the stage. They stayed in the wings just to watch him. Of course, the house goes crazy at the end, blah, and dozens of marvelous night. Everybody goes off to the dressing rooms. He proceeds to smash his dressing room to pieces. I mean, they could hear, and this fury in the cursing that was going on in the dressing room. And so that heroic grouping of people known as a theatrical company sent the youngest stage manager to knock on the door to find out what was wrong. So eventually, she was knocking on the door and he just, she said, "Sir Lawrence, you know, what's the matter?" Because it was just absolutely marvellous. And he said, "I know, but I don't know why."
Now, you're here living in New York in the midst of what can only be described as a bizarre American political moment.
Well, no more bizarre than what's going on in my country. Why are we coming out the European Union?
Well, I protest. I think ours is more bizarre than yours, but I'll let you argue it. What's going on?
In my country, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, clearly, the negotiations are going very slowly.
Talking about Brexit.
Absolutely. And Parliament did manage to get the right to post the deal being signed off, to argue for or against it, examine it in detail. But we'll have to wait and see.
I'm asking something broader, even global, you'll forgive me.
Oh, well.
You know, you're talking about an illiberalism that has swept from Hungary to the United States to Britain to almost everywhere.
Absolutely.
What has happened in your estimation?
Immigration.
You think that's the key to it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's something that if I simply look at my own country, all the political parties, in my view, tap danced around that issue for a good decade. And what we were getting was concern about the lack of affordable housing, not being able to get your child into the school of your choice. The NHS, that's our National Health Service, fraying at the edges. And because there was this kind of politically correct thing that said that if you were questioning the number of people who were coming into your area from other parts of the world, often fleeing death and destruction, but not exclusively, if you objected to that, then you were obviously some form of racist. People put down the issues that I've raised with you to one of the, well, three major supports of the European Union, namely the free movement of people. Now, the issues that they raised, which had to do with unaffordable housing, schools, NHS, none of those were issues which were the responsibility of or to any interest in that sense to the European Union. They were all issues which were the duty and responsibility to handle of the British government, whichever political party was in power, didn't do it. And so when the referendum came along, that seemed to me to afford an opportunity to blame it all on the European Union.
What's a sane policy then for immigration? Because even as someone, as a woman of the left, you are not denying that immigration causes it or leads to cultural destruction in certain ways.
So because it's not handled. I mean, and it is very difficult. I mean, I'm sitting here pontificating. I mean, it is very, very difficult to try and convince people that the changes that are going to be inevitable in this planet that we're inhabiting can be handled only by us all talking to each other. We have to talk to each other. When I say we, I mean the countries of the world as well as the individuals.
Theresa May not be your political or ideological cup of tea.
She's the only adult in the room at the moment with this, you know, and I think the way she's being treated by her own party and particularly by her cabinet is shameful and disgraceful.
So you have some sympathy for her?
I have a lot of sympathy for her because she is in an impossible situation.
Who's the bad guy in the scenario, Boris Johnson?
Oh, no. I mean, in essence, really, the person who made the biggest error was David Cameron, who called the referendum in the first instance. Now, he called it to quiet his own backbenchers. There have always been this group of conservative, well, I can't think of a harsh enough term for them, who have always wanted to come out of Europe and have this complete fantasy about what it will be like. I was shocked. I was shocked at the way some parts of the United Kingdom voted to come out. I didn't think they would.
Three Tall Women closes at somewhere in the late summer.
The end of June, I think, yes.
Ah, sooner than that. Mm-hmm. What have you got planned for the near future?
Well, nothing definite. I mean, there are things I'm looking at, but nothing specific.
But
what's
the principle of how you look from project to project? What is it that you want to do?
I have no preconceptions. You're lucky to be given the job. I mean, that's the bottom line as far as I'm concerned.
So we should close by saying Glenda Jackson is open to offers.
Well, yes, you can. But, I'll know by the first page whether I want to do it or not.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Glenda Jackson. She's just been nominated for a Tony for her performance in Three Tall Women, on Broadway.